That's the
joy. Yes. There it is.
Da-da-da-da!
And
that
memory.
Is how you defend the world.
Yeah.
That is how
that's
you
how you do it, boys.
That was awesome.
All right. Welcome to the State of Games. I'm Dice Hate Me.
And this is Monkey 238.
And this is episode 10, or as we like to call it, the one about Origins, as in Origins Game Fair, that big old convention in Columbus, Ohio every year. Are you ready to talk about Origins, Monkey?
I don't really have anything to say because I wasn't there.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. What okay. were you doing while I was away?
Making the big bucks and studying and doing secret stuff that maybe we'll talk about later.
Okay. I think we can talk about that later.
Okay.
It's all secret. Before you take off, though, can you talk about our sponsor?
Oh, yeah. We'd like to take this moment to thank Eagle and Griffin Games for sponsoring this episode of The State of Games. You can help them by visiting Kickstarter and searching for Mirror Mirror, their newest project from designer Jacob Davenport. It's a really cool twist on classic chess with mirrors. It's a bit thinky, but we like that.
And yeah, Eagle and Griffin have been putting out a lot of great stuff lately. And they were also in full force at Origins, and they had great deals on games like Defenders of the Realm, which I personally bought, and I'll be talking about in a few minutes, as well as my newest addiction, Pitch Car. You like Pitch Car, right?
Yeah.
You got a little more into it than I thought you would.
What did you expect?
I don't know. I didn't know if you'd like it or not.
I liked it. I like flicking my fingers, I guess.
Awesome.
Whatever. I'll see you in a bit.
Okay.
Ciao.
Ciao. Despite what you may have heard about Origins being a huge convention spread out over a long period of time, I'm here to tell you that there's not enough time to do hardly anything you really want to do. Thankfully, I was able to pack a lot of great things into a small amount of time. And as you can probably tell from my voice, I've gotten a little bit hoarse from my time over there because of all the laughing and the talking and just the great amount of camaraderie that is in the board game community. So throughout this podcast, I'm going to share small snippets of things that I was able to tape and lucky enough to participate in and just experience a great gaming community, a thriving community. And that was the most important thing for me at Origins, was to be able to connect with all these people that are really passionate about what they do and passionate about the community in which they live and game. And the most important thing that I came away from this was those connections. The experiences and the memories that I have from Origins 2011 will be with me, but most importantly, the friends that I made along the way are what is really going to make a difference, and I just hope that all of them can prosper at all of their endeavors. I've made sure that I played a lot of prototypes this weekend. I met a lot of aspiring designers, as well as talked to some people who are established in the business or who are just getting started in the business. So I just want to take time to share it all with you. A few of the small little experiences that I had, a couple of them are interviews. Some of these are things that I'm particularly interested in, but I hope that all of you will be as well. First up, I was lucky enough on one of the first days to play Defenders of the Realm by Eagle and Griffin Games. The designer was Richard Launius. I'd been a fan of Richard's for a long, long time. I played his original design of Arkham Horror back in the late 80s, early 90s. Back before it was signed and brought on by Fantasy Flight Games and transformed into one of the best-selling games in the genre right now. The current Arkham Horror is one of my favorite games, probably in my top 20, if not my top 10. And the chance to sit down with Richard and just experience the game with him was fantastic. We played Defenders. He taught it to us. It was the first time that I'd ever experienced it. I avoided Defenders at first because I was a little trepidatious about it. I had heard some people compare it to Pandemic and stating that it was just a Pandemic derivative. Not that I felt that was a bad thing, but Pandemic being a great game, not always my favorite. A lot of people tend to like cooperative games, including Monkey. And it's one of her favorite games of all time, and I love playing it with her. But I tend to enjoy competitive games or games that allow us to be cooperative in some instances, but go off and do your own thing in others. Defenders turned out to be that game. I was not really privy to that until Richard took us through the game and played the entire game out with us. He is one of the most enthusiastic and friendliest game designers that I've ever run into. And here is a snippet from our beginning quest in Defenders of the Realm on Richard's comments about how Defenders compares to Pandemic.
You know, a lot of people compare this to Pandemic. Pandemic's a puzzle, okay? It has a, it's a good puzzle, but it's a puzzle. Yeah. And there's really one solution to
it. There's always an optimal...
Right. So the guy who's played Pandemic 30 times can tell everybody, you not only do you need to do this, you have to do this, and the bad news is he's correct.
Correct, right,
okay?
Right.
That's the problem of it being a game. That's why I say it's the comparison to this is totally different, because guess what? Even if you do the most optimum thing in this, you're rolling these things.
Yep.
And it's always best made plans go south.
That's good. That's good. Yeah.
So you can't rely.
That's an interesting way to look at it.
But I will say that one of the differences when you roll these, it's controlled one. And when I finally get a Euro player to play this, they've always had a, here's what they do. They'll go, okay, I'm attacking. Oh, I didn't get them. How many wounds did I take? I go, none. They're like, what? None. I said, you got more actions. Run away, fight again, do something. Yeah. You know, you're a hero. Act like a hero. So I'm not. They immediately think it's going to be this punishment type system that, you know, I'm going to roll dice and the dice are going to be mean to me and I'm going to lose the game because the dice are mean to me. It's controlled luck.
Well, it probably happened to me, yes. But.
Well, it's controlled luck. Look, what I would tell somebody, look, if you charge into three undead by yourself with one action left and you roll a dice,
well, you're being stupid,
You just basically spit in fate's eye and said, you know, I don't care, and you're going to get hammered. But if you said, look, I have four actions, I can attack three times, I can retreat, you know, you made a calculated decision.
Right.
And that's kind of how you've got to play this game. And to be honest with you, when they get past that initial thing, they have a great time. And this is a common quote. I get this all the time. This isn't all like that. No. And the people who said that when it came out never played it. You know, they never played it. And by the way, you know, we talked to the designer of campaign before we came out and said, here's our game. What do you think? Well, it's nothing like it. You know, share some mechanics. Show me a game that doesn't share some.
Oh, of course. Exactly.
But, you know, it's a total different feel because it's a total fantasy game.
In addition to playing Defenders, I talked to Richard a little bit about his upcoming title, Elder Sign, from Fantasy Flight Games. It's going to be a dice-based game that involves cards and dice together. I don't know a whole lot about it. I wanted to take a little more of a chance to talk to Richard, but he was a madman throughout the entire convention, playing Defenders back-to-back-to-back for so many people there. He was in every single game I ever saw him participating in. He was just as enthusiastic as that first game we played with him. I got a chance to talk to him a few times throughout the convention, just asking him how he was doing and all of his upcoming projects. And he has said that he will come on the State of Games podcast probably toward the end of summer, so we can talk a bit about his upcoming game release from Eagle and Griffin Games, Dragon Rampage, but also talk a bit about Elder Sign. And I would like to take a chance to just interview him about Arkham Horror and how he came up with the initial concept for that. So look for that on State of Games soon. One of the great things I was able to do at Origins was meet Philip DeBerry. We had talked back and forth several times, and in my preview for Origins, I mentioned that he was going to play Revolution with me. He had promised to do so. I was also going to get a sneak peek at Kingdom of Solomon, which I had mentioned in the previous podcast. And Monkey and I had taken a look at the initial Kickstarter campaign that he has. It is still up on Kickstarter right now. It is Kingdom of Solomon. I highly encourage you to go and check out this game on Kickstarter. After playing it with Philip, I can 100% guarantee this game. It is a solid Euro. It has a smooth gameplay, a lot of flexible choices, a great system where you're able to buy actions and resources with your victory points. So you have a variable victory point scale that is able to use for currency, which I have not really played with a whole lot of games with that type of thing. I also got a chance to sit down and play Revolution with him, as he promised. And let me tell you, the guy definitely knows his own game. He had the designer advantage. He smoked all of us. But I had a great time. It was well worth the wait. I wanted to play that game for over 2 years. And it was fantastic to be able to sit down and play that with Philip. Here is a small snippet from the beginning of the game when Sean, my buddy Sean, and I sat down with Philip to play Kingdom of Solomon and get our first taste of it. And this is Philip describing the basic gameplay.
We're here with Philip DeBerry on the floor of the boardroom at Origins 2011 and about to test Kingdom of Solomon.
All right, so what color is your one?
If nobody minds, I'll be blue.
Okay.
Green, is that right?
Yeah. So you're one of Solomon's governors, and you're trying to expand the empire, try to improve it, and be, I guess, the most successful governor. And so there's four different phases. First one is the placement phase, where we're actually just gonna use six or five of our pawns. That's for four of us, and so we're just gonna take turns putting these on any one of the resource spaces, and you're gonna get some resources or one of the action spaces. Or, after we get going, you could play on one of these big bonus spaces. If you do that, though, it costs all the rest of your pawns. And then you get whatever it is. So then, after everybody places their pawns, then we do the resolution, and we get whatever it is you can't go do. Then we do the market, which starts empty. If you sell in there, you get that many points. And then you can buy, too. And once you pass, you're out of the buying and selling for that round. And then finally we can build, and I'll put some cards out. We'll start with these four. Let's see. You can build one of these cards if you have this amount saved up. And you can also build as many roads as you want. They cost two timber and a food. And I'll explain what those do in a minute. And then you can build as many blocks of the temple as you want. You have to start with the foundation ones, which is stone and anything you want. Right, and then it goes to the structure, and then finally the columns. And these are worth victory points, or you can get a token, which we're just using these as the tokens.
Okay.
And whoever has the most tokens has control of the High Priest, which lets you go in other people's spots once per turn.
Now, I also had a chance to talk with Randall Bills of Catalyst Game Labs. I posted this interview in the middle of my Origins coverage on DiceHateMe.com, but I wanted to include this on the podcast so that everyone would have a chance to listen to it in the context of Origins. When I went to Origins, it was number one on my list of things to check out as far as new game releases. And Leviathans is, for most people who want to know, it is a miniatures-based war game that is basically about these large armored warships that are powered by Tesla coils. And so it means that they can sort of levitate, and it's basically large, huge battleships that have taken on aerial battles. The miniatures war system is streamlined, and I used to be an old miniatures war gamer, and I got a chance to demo Leviathans, and the game is pretty complex, but the system that they've made where you only really have to reference the card that is in front of you with each individual ship that's in your fleet is brilliant. You don't have a ton of lists in a book where you have to go and look up modifiers. You can sit down, have all of your fleet right in front of you, mark out what has been exposed, hull breaches, and you can add as many or as few of the rules of the system as you want. You can play a base game that basically just sits you down and you're just blasting each other in the air. You can add additional advanced maneuvers, wind conditions, all sorts of things, boarding parties, ramming actions, all of the advanced rules, and they can be brought in piece by piece by piece, and the way the rule system is laid out does that as well. Sean and I had a chance to play Leviathans with a small fleet of only two ships. He took on the role of the French, who were fast moving, had more cannons but weren't as experienced in crew, and did not have as large a cannon or as heavily armored ships as I did as the British. I was slow, but I had more experienced crew. In the end, Sean turned out to be the one who could outmaneuver me and surround me and took out my engine on my main cruiser. So we had to call that a complete draw after an hour. Just for completion's sake, here is Randall Bills describing Leviathans and the future of Catalyst Game Labs.
This is Chris from Dice Hate Me, and I'm on the floor at Origins 2011 with Randall Bills, developer and designer of Leviathans from Catalyst Game Labs.
Good to be here, and glad to be talking with you.
Thank you. So about Leviathans, I'm a huge like Zeppelin freak and love steampunk. And I know a lot of my readership does as well. Just tell us a little bit about Leviathans and the development you went through to make it happen.
Well, it actually, two, 3.5 years ago now, I think, John Hayward, who's been a BattleTech volunteer for a couple years, came to us with a concept, and it was like a one-page proposal. and he had taken some art that was actually from another computer game that he had just found online that said, wow, this is kind of the vision, and paired that with a one-page introduction. And then he'd actually done a whole game design with and everything else, but that one page and that one image just sold the concept on us. Yeah. Now, obviously, we couldn't use that image, but it was close enough that it gave us a taste of what Leviathans might eventually become.
Right.
We did look at the design, and while the design was really nice, it just wasn't something that we felt, it felt a little too dated. It might have been something that came out in the late 80s or early 90s, and so we felt we wanted to do something a little more accessible, a little more exciting and new. And so, you know, we kind of took the rules and wadded them up and threw them in a corner, and then started fully developing a brand new game system while pairing up with Doug Chafee, who's magnificent artist, to help start doing the concept work.
Yeah.
And Doug Chafee, he has a long, long history in naval art. There's admirals that own his artwork. You know, it's pretty impressive. And so he had the chops to be able to kind of keep us grounded in, you know, real-world Navy while allowing me to constantly be kicking, you know, hey, can we make it a little more this or we can make it a little more that?
Right.
One of the things that we tried really hard with Leviathans, particularly with the visuals, is there's a lot of games that take the visuals and they just run off in really far left and right and up and down directions. And that's fine. That's great. You know, it kind of reminds me of like the last Exile anime. There's some really brilliant looking stuff in there. But we felt that we hadn't really seen somebody put together a game and a universe that was more kind of pure Edwardian science fiction.
Yeah.
That was fairly true to the look of that period, but just tweaked it a little bit here and there. And so for those of your readership that read Harry Turtledove, he's like the master of alternate history.
Absolutely.
And one of the reasons why he does it so well, in my opinion, is that he changes just one pivotal thing, and then he tries to be as realistic as possible about, and here's how the world would develop with just that one change.
Right, right.
And so there were quite a few times where we were veering off left or right, and as a collective whole, we would kind of pull ourselves back in and go, no, I don't think it would actually have developed that way. I think it would have developed like this. Now, obviously, there were some concessions where we're like, you know what, we're telling a story here. We have to be able to develop this story and have it be exciting. So sometimes you do have to make concessions there. Sometimes with the visuals, we're like, okay, are they actually going to be able to create a model that mirrors the craziness that we're doing?
Right, right.
And the studio that we're working with actually had to create some brand new tooling techniques to be able to create some of the details because of how crazy some of it was.
The models are amazing, and the detail on it is fantastic. I mean, with Games Workshop, the things they've done with plastics right now has been incredible. Your models rival or beat them. I mean, the detail is fantastic, and they are all plastic. That's correct.
Yeah, yeah. All the miniatures in the box set is high impact polystyrene (HIPS), which is what Games Workshop uses. It's pretty much a War Machine. Anyone that's doing really high quality plastics, that's the type they're using. And yeah, I don't quite understand all of it. I would love to go over to China and actually sit for a couple of hours on their floor to see how it's done.
Right.
But they have this brand new technique of these crazy molds that they're using that allow them to create the level of detail that we have on there.
That's awesome. As far as the rule system, most of the people who listen to our podcast or read Dice Hate Me, they're traditional board gamers, but a lot of them have either been, you know, expat miniature gamers like me, you know, who have experience. But for people who are more just traditional board gamers, do you think this game will be accessible to them, the rule system, or is it a little more complex than what they're used to?
I'm hoping that it's accessible. When I first started developing the rules, I'm the same thing. I've been playing board games and war games far longer than I care to admit. And the initial system was very much 2d10 against a target number with pages of modifiers.
Right.
And one of the things that started to dawn on me as the images were coming in and as I realized, you know, it's funny, you have a lot of people that'll walk by, just a side tangent for a moment, that'll walk by and be like, oh, you're, you know, hopping on a steampunk wagon. And I'm like, well, we actually started developing this like 3.5 years ago when a lot of people hadn't even heard of it yet. And we realized this was coming and we wanted to be a part of it. But a lot of that crowd are not that hardcore gamers. And so we wanted to make sure that if somebody's walking by and they're just suddenly pulled right to check the minis out, and we've seen it endlessly, like the 2 years ago at Gen Con when we had the very first peek at what the minis might look like. I remember even women stopping by and just sitting there and staring at it, which, you know, is almost unheard of in tabletop miniature gaming.
Right, right.
Unless
there's elves involved.
Well, unless there's elves involved, exactly. So I got thinking to myself, you know what, this is far too intimidating. So we kept playtesting, and I kept banging on different ideas. How can we do this different? And to be honest, it's so long ago, I don't exactly remember what the epiphany moment was. But it suddenly dawned on me that the combination of bell curves from polyhedral dice can mimic all the modifiers that you would normally have within a game.
Right.
So you can take all the modifiers you got out there and hide them down into the mechanics so that somebody who isn't really a gamer doesn't have to worry about any of those type of mechanics, but they're still all in there. Because if you had taken them all out, you wouldn't have a game. There'd be no tactics.
Right.
There'd be no reason to move or try to get in a better position. You're all just sitting there firing. That's boring. No one's ever going to play my game again.
Yes.
So you had to keep all of that in there. For those that have seen monstersinthesky.com or the photos we put up in there, all the dice are D12s in shape, but in reality they're just polyhedral dice. So the green dice is a D4, the blue dice is a D6, yellow dice is a D8, the red is a D10, and then the black is a D12.
Right.
And the reason I went with all one shape is twofold. One, you know, to be honest, it's just cheaper to do one mold. But two, again, getting back to that, if you're not that much of a gamer, then there's a chance that the different shaped dice, you may never have seen them, and then you might get hung up on that. Well, why is this shape like this, or why is this shape like that?
Right.
As opposed to, if you're a hardcore gamer, I explain it to you once, and you're like, oh, I got it. I don't need to worry about
it.
Exactly. Yeah. So this way, it's all color-coded. You're looking at your ship card. It's got the colored circle. All they got to do is reach for that colored dice. They're rolling dice. They're having a good time. So, but at the same time, I also don't want those who might be listening to think, well, is it too simple? I tried very hard to build it up in stages so that the quick start rules are absolutely simple, easy to get into. But then we have the commander's manual, which is the full rules that you'll get in the core box set when it's released. And that has many, many additional rules that add in a whole new tactics of play, screenings, aerial torpedoes, ramming, repairs. There's a lot in there. And then we have another product under development. We originally were trying to get in the core box set, but production finally came back to me and said, I've got to start trimming stuff out of this because there's just too much in it.
Yeah.
And so we have a product called the Captain's Box Set that'll come out down the line that has the Captain's Manual in that, and that has a whole other level of enhanced scenario rules from wind and weather, visibility, crew abilities, all the way to the all-important elevation rules that'll appear in there. And we tried really hard to make those so that they're plug and play.
Right.
So a lot of games, they'll come out with an advanced rule book, but you have to take whole sections of it at a time, or else they don't quite balance out. Whereas we tried to make it so that every time somebody sits down, they can go, I'm going to do the wind this game. And then they do it. And next time they're like, well, I'm going to put cloud templates on. Or the next time I'm like, oh, I'm going to do, you know, critical gun battery failure rule.
Right.
And so there's a lot of flexibility that allows each group to do, you know, whatever they want and what they enjoy to do.
So none of the advanced rules, if they're taken out, will harm the base system at all. People can play with the base set and then add on what they want to try to build up to that, or just play the base set, and it's completely enjoyable otherwise, right?
Absolutely. For those who might know me and have been following me, I've been doing BattleTech for, again, far longer than I ever care to admit.
Yeah.
And over the last 4 or 5 years, we've been working on the new, you know, Origins award-winning line of rule books, and the the depth of play that I tried to put in there, the style of the whole kitchen sink, it really was kind of a training ground of how do I do this massive book of all these rules and try to make those plug and play.
Right.
And that kind of was allowed me to cut my teeth on that. So then as I'm working on Leviathans, it's not nearly as complex as BattleTech, not even remotely close. But it still allowed me to have that mentality of, okay, here's how you design various rules that you can just pick and play each time without harming either the core rules or without having to take five or six at a time.
Yeah, that makes total sense to me. I mean, I'm really excited about the system. I've read through the rule book once. This, to me, as an ex-miniatures wargamer, I just can't get into like buying thousands of miniatures and taking all that time to paint, but having a manageable fleet, what would be, how many miniatures would you need to have a manageable fleet to have a good game?
Well, the core box set has 8 ships in it. There's a battleship, light cruiser, and 2 destroyers for the British and for the French. And that experience right there is great. I've played dozens and dozens of that game by now. In fact, I've played so many times that often my son, who loves Leviathans, who's been really instrumental a lot in a lot of some of the game decisions, almost doesn't want to play anymore because he's like, oh, it's the same ship. So I'm like, no, we got to keep at it. You know, right. We got to make sure it works.
Right.
But yeah, a lot of people always are like, how long does it take? And you can do the quick start rules are 2 ships on a side, a destroyer and a light cruiser. And after 2 or 3 games, you can play that in like 30 minutes flat, no problem. The full experience of the game with the 8 miniatures, so 4 on a side. Again, get 2 or 3 games under your belt so you understand some of the battleship rules and the aerial torpedoes. And again, that's a 90-120 minute game tops.
Okay.
At the same time, when the core box set releases, we'll also be releasing 2 fleet boxes. So you have the British fleet box and the French fleet box. Those will have the ships, the exact same ships that are in the core box set, but they'll have their own unique ship cards. So somebody can buy the core box set and then instantly double their fleet.
Yeah.
I've played twice now, I think. I've played 20-plus ships on the board. Actually, I think it was 22. It's every ship card that we had.
Wow.
And I played it, went through almost the entire game in one long Saturday afternoon and into the evening.
Yeah.
So it scales really well. You still get that feel of movement. You get the tactics of, it's got all that wonderful naval feel of crossing the T and trying to get into that stern, protecting your destroyer so they can try to flank around and get in the stern of those battleships, take their movement down. It's got all that wonderful, wonderful tactics in there.
Sounds awesome. And as a military history buff, just taking this into the, like I said, the Edwardian sci-fi, it's a brilliant concept, and I can't wait. And exactly when do you think the release date is scheduled for right now?
Well, we don't have a specific street date. Everyone keeps asking for that, and we've learned from long experience that until it's on our soil, and even better, until it's in our warehouse, you just can't say that.
Right.
Literally, files are uploading at the convention. I've been, like I said earlier, I was up to like 3 a.m. reviewing last proof so that Matt can upload it in the morning. So the trigger has been pulled. We hope to have box sets at Gen Con for sale.
Oh, wow.
And then we're saying late summer, early fall for when it'll actually be available in stores.
That's fantastic.
When we have a street date and when we can start pre-ordering, I'll be yelling it as loud as I possibly can, posting it, Twitter, doing everything I can to get that out there.
Well, we'll be listening, and I appreciate it. Again, this was Randall Bills, designer and developer of Leviathans. And what's your official title for Catalyst?
Managing developer.
Managing developer.
I try to make the trains run on time. So.
Well, awesome. Well, good luck to you, and I appreciate the interview.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
All right.
Now, for anyone who's been following Dice Hate Me throughout the week for the coverage of Origins, they've seen plenty of pictures of me sitting down with David McKenzie and Fred McKenzie from Clever Mojo Games. And of course, on Dice Hate Me, no shock to anyone, I've been covering Clever Mojo Games since almost the beginning of the blog. We've become friends online and have been involved with a lot of the development of some of the prototypes. Got a chance to take my first crack at many of them. Sunrise City was one of them that I had played previously, but I was privileged to sit down with David, Fred, our friend Mark Spector, and Sean, and go through a full game of Sunrise City. And we had a really great time. In addition to Sunrise City, which will probably be coming out first in their line of future productions or publishings, We also got a chance to sit down and play Swinging Jive Cat Voodoo Lounge, which I've covered on DiceHateMe.com. And I'm here to tell you that if there is one game you need to keep an eye on for 2012, it is Swinging Jive Cat Voodoo Lounge. I can predict now after playing it that it will be in the contention for my game of the year. And I'm not saying that simply because I'm preferential to Clever Mojo Games because of the quality and the type of people that David and Fred are, but also because this game is like almost nothing that I've played before. The theme, the feel of the game, the play of the game, fantastic. And every single one of the players that played, it was myself and Fred, David, Sean, and John Muller of Car Trunk Entertainment, sat down to play the game, and we all had the same experience. It was a very nice, tight play, had a lot of wild card opportunities, a lot of scoring combos, and at the end, it lasted only about an hour, but it even felt shorter than that. It was a perfect game for what it is and the theme that it encompasses. So I will have more on DiceHateMe.com about that game as it comes out. Now, in addition to that, I also have a chance to sit down with David and play his prototype for his game, Sailing Toward Osiris. And that game was a really tight Euro-type of experience, but also had a very vibrant haggling and bartering system that is wide open in the game. And it's unlike most games that I've experienced. In Catan, you can say, well, I'll trade you wood for sheep, the usual. But this system is wide open in the sense that you could trade anything, you know, victory points, which are glory points you can get through during the day, the game. You could trade resources for certain things. You could trade almost up to monuments, some of your workers. It was wide open in that, and it opened up a huge social aspect to the game that David was unsure was going to be there in the beginning. In addition to that, Princess of the Dragon Throne, that is being developed by Clever. In addition to that, Princess of the Dragon Throne, which I have shown many, many previews of the card art, is also one that I got a chance to test. And although it's in the middle of production now, I can tell you that the elements that are there in the game are fantastic and are some of the elements that I've not seen in many games up to this point. But anyway, I'll have more of these and thoughts on these in DiceHateMe.com in the coming weeks. But for now, I got a chance to sit down with David McKenzie and talk to him about these prototypes and the future of Clever Mojo Games. And he was gracious enough to do it even though he was almost hoarse from all of the work that he had done in his booth throughout the week.
All right, this is Chris from Dice Hate Me on the floor at Origins 2011 with David McKenzie from Clever Mojo Games.
Hi, Chris.
We're no strangers to each other by this point. Most of you have followed the blogs. You've seen they've been prototyping most of their 2012 releases, or hopeful 2012 releases. We've been here, and he's been selling Alien Frontiers. The main questions that we want to talk about today is what's the future for Clever Mojo, and what exactly we can expect from Alien Frontiers and the 2012 releases. So let's start with Alien Frontiers. First off, I've mentioned on the podcast and the blog that you have an expansion of Alien Frontiers coming out. Can you tell us a little bit more about it?
The first expansion we expect to have out for Alien Frontiers will be probably early 2012. It's called Factions, and it will add a special mini board for each player. They can choose one of eight boards. That'll give them a special orbital power of their own that only they can use, and it'll give them another orbital power that other players can use if they dock a ship there and pay a fuel to the owner of that mini board. It will also have eight new alien tech cards, and it will have a deck of cards called Agendas, which are basically hidden goals. You get dealt one of those cards at the beginning, and those are the territories you need to control by the end of the game. And if you do, you get an extra victory point for each of those three territories. So with that, there will not be an exact knowledge of what the score is while you're playing the game. You'll know what the obvious score is, but those three hidden agendas can mean the difference between winning and losing in the end, because when you flip them over, if you made your agendas, you might zoom ahead of the person who thought he was in the lead.
Right. So you've noticed that in playtesting so far, has it equaled much closer games? Because Alien Frontiers already has a very tight scoring system.
Yes.
Has that related into someone who obviously thought they were winning the game to be an upset to the end?
There's been a lot of complaint of leader bashing, so this may obscure exactly who's in the lead. You may have to watch the board more for people's patterns on where they're going and trying to suss out their agendas to know who's actually in the lead. So I think it may help mitigate that just a little bit.
Right. Well, obviously I'm going to be playing the prototypes. We'll have more about that on DiceHaven.com pretty soon. We're going to actually play tonight, hopefully, if we get a chance. That's the plan. We get through with interviewing and everything else we got going on here. One last question about Alien Frontiers. When you first announced the Kickstarter campaign was successful, you also were talking about bringing out an iPhone app.
Yes.
How far along in the process is that, and when do you think people can look for that?
The iOS app, which will probably be an iPad app initially, and then later on come to iPhone. I'm hoping for release in about 1 to 2 months. We had hoped to have it ready to show off here at Origins, but didn't quite make it. Programming is pretty intensive to get the whole look and feel correct. So we should have it in a month or two.
Awesome. What do you think the price point is going to be for that?
I think we're probably talking $5.99, $6.99, something like that.
Sounds good. From Alien Frontiers, you are going to be releasing, hopefully, late 2011, early 2012 to mid-2012, possibly three titles. Three of those that I've tested here. And the first of all, we I guess the furthest you have along is Sunrise City.
Yes.
And I've had previews of that on Dice Hate Me as well. What is your printing schedule for that? Are you going to run that through Kickstarter and then beyond that print in early 2012?
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking we'll probably run it through either Kickstarter or Springboard, one or the other. And we're hoping that we would be able to get adequate funding for it in time to have it released by the end of the year. We've already got the artist working on the art for the city laying tiles and whatnot. So I'm hopeful.
Sunrise City itself, we've been playing it here. And a matter of fact, we've had a good time with it. And it seems pretty tight right now. Isaias, I know you guys are tweaking a few more of the rule sets. When do you think that you will have it all tightened up and actually released on Kickstarter or Springboard? What is your projected date?
Oh, goodness. Let's see. Right now we're near the end of June.
Welcome to Origins.
Yeah. I would hope that we'll have the art wrapped up by the end of August at the very latest, and then be able to start Kickstarter as soon as that's done. We'll probably go for a 30-day window on Kickstarter, or Springboard. And if we can get the adequate funding, then we'll go right to press. I don't like to start a funding project until I have the product nearly complete. So once we get to that stage, we're going to have it ready to go.
Right. Okay. One project that has me particularly excited is Swingin' Jive Cat Voodoo Lounge, which I actually got my first play of last night. I'll have more thoughts about that in written form on DiceHateMe.com. But right now, do you project that Sunrise City will go ahead of Swingin' Jive Cat Voodoo Lounge?
Yeah, definitely. The art for Sunrise City is actually in production and doing well. Swingin' Jive Cat Voodoo Lounge, we've identified an artist, Sergey Marcet, and he'll be doing the work for us, but his schedule's busy right now, and he can't get to it until later in the year. So probably it'll give us time to totally refine the rules a little bit and the gameplay smoothness, and then we'll probably launch that one on Kickstarter, I would think, probably early next year.
Sounds awesome. As far as the projects that you have down the pipeline, you also have Princes of the Dragon Throne.
Yeah.
We've had a lot of previews of the art on that so far. I know that artist Donna Gia has really excelled and almost completed the art. Is that correct?
Yeah, Don Aguilo is our artist, and he's doing an excellent job. We're over halfway through the art production phase, so we're very, very hopeful, and we're super stoked about the art he's done. The dragons and the citizen characters are just beautiful.
But now, originally you had started production on Princess of the Dragon Throne with a certain design motif deck building game. You've kind of switched gears a little bit from that. Can you tell me exactly why you decided to do that?
We had a deck building game version of the Princess of the Dragon Throne, which was adequate and just needed probably a little bit of tweaking to make it totally functional. But we didn't think it distinguished itself enough from every other deck building game out there. So we wanted to create something that was a little bit different and a little bit unique and could stand apart from everything else. So we went back to the designing board and started working over on it again. and I think we're getting to a really good point with it.
And you describe it basically as a tableau building game, basically. That's kind of what, can you describe a little bit what that means?
Well, I'm calling it basically a card-driven area control game. So you're building a tableau of dragons and citizens who are basically launching a rebellion against the king. And some of those citizens are used to generate the resources you need to keep that rebellion going. And others are assigned to give influence in the different areas of the kingdom so that you can spread your revolution around the kingdom and defeat the king.
Right.
We do have... Oh, yes, we do. We have Fred McKenzie, who is walking away from us now. He must be a little shy.
He is very shy. He almost didn't come. He's just he's a very shy person.
All right. We'll settle for not talking to Fred for now, but I'm going to keep wrangling after him and see if we can get him on the podcast before too long.
I think you're going to have a stealth microphone if you want to do that.
Maybe I'll just send him a drink or two. We'll get him a little loosened up, see what he does.
A few more beers and you see what you can do.
There you go.
Beyond the projects that you have in the pipeline right now, you also have a game that you've started to work with called Sailing Toward Osiris.
Yes.
I know you've not announced a lot about that, but you did bring your prototype.
Yes.
And we've played it, and we really enjoyed it. And for everybody out there, this is maybe the first mention of it other than the mentions that you made in Twitter or on Twitter. Can you tell us just a little bit about what the game is about and what your inspirations of the game?
The game is very roughly an Egyptian setting. Pharaoh is dead, and his barge is progressing down the Nile toward his resting place with Osiris. And that sailing process acts as the game clock, basically. And the players have a certain number of turns in order to build monuments to Osiris's glory, or to Pharaoh's glory, rather, before he gets to Osiris. And they'll use laborers along the edges of the Nile to get the materials they need to build the monuments and to feed the peoples.
The major mechanic of the game, from what we were playing, is a worker placement game, but also sort of a resource placement game. But I think the heart of the game, from what we felt, was the trading and bartering aspect, which I don't know if did you necessarily intend that to be at the heart, or were you mean it to be more of like a straightforward worker placement sort of mechanic?
I meant it to be a very dull, boring game with lots of quiet contemplation of where to put your laborers and how to get the resources you need. But then I turned it loose with my playtesters, and it evolved into a very free-form, exuberant bartering game where people were bartering for whatever they had in their control and whatever future actions they may be able to make on the game. So it just kind of, one of those emergent properties of the game. It's totally unforeseen, and it's actually really totally changed and I think improved the game.
Yeah. Well, we had a great time. I mean, just the haggling portion of it is hilarious in itself, which is quite a juxtaposition with the theme of this sailing of a funeral barge down the Nile toward, you know, towards the afterlife. But it makes sense when you play it all together, which is quite interesting to have a theme that bears fruit in another manner.
Yeah.
I know as a designer that has to be, of course, always a surprise, but at the same time fulfilling, because when you create something that is open enough to allow interpretation by the gamers and it kind of creates its own self, that has to be very fulfilling.
Yeah, it is. You know, like I said, it started out being a very dull, boring game. I mean, it was one of those things where you had the mechanics that would really work, I thought, and I had a theme that was nice and, you know, thematic and meaty, but the playtesters just took it in a totally different direction, and it's the better for it. It's great.
Yeah. Well, we had a great time, and I know you're going to be continuing to develop that. Right now, from what you've told me, your production schedule is going to be probably Sunrise City and then progressing to Swingin' Jive Cafe, Voodoo Lounge, plus Princess of the Dragon Throne, maybe around the same time.
All right.
Possibly Princes first, depending on the development schedule of that. Do you see Sailing Toward Osiris taking a backseat until most of those are done, or would you try to publish concurrently?
I am pretty much committed to doing Sunrise City and Jive Cat Lounge and Princess of the Dragon Throne first. Sailing Toward Osiris being my own, and pretty much satisfied with putting that on a back burner until the other things get handled first.
Great.
As far as you've been eliciting design help and also getting designers to sign with you from your local area, Isaias and Seth being the designers of Sunrise City and Swingin' Jive Cat Voodoo Lounge respectively, would you be opening up for design submissions from other people for Clever Mojo in 2012?
Possibly. I've had several people here at Origins ask me about accepting new prototypes, and I've told them all that I'd really, really love to hear their game and play their game with them, but having the three or four titles in the works right now, I just don't have the time to dedicate that they would need to have. I don't feel it's fair to them to lead them on and tell them, you know, yes, I'll look at your game and then do nothing with it.
Right.
So it's much better to just tell them I'd love to, but I can't. In 2012, these other games get released, that could very well change.
Right.
Well, it sounds like you got a good future, and obviously we'll be putting more on DiceHateMe.com, so look for that there, and thank you for your time.
Glad to be here, thank you.
Mark Spector is a fan of Dice Hate Me, and I got a chance to meet him, and I can tell you that he is an incredible guy. He ran demos and taught games throughout the entire time we were there, and somehow he found a time to sit down and play some games with us, but also teach us some games that we were interested in. One group that he was representing at Origins was R&R Games, and they have a game called Hey Waiter that we sat down and played. I've been interested in that game since the Designer Diary on Board Game Geek. That was a lot of fun, and I'd like to get a copy of that if I can find one. There was not one available at Origins. But the real hit for us and for most of the people who came around to see and play the game was Time's Up Title Recall. This is a game that was basically it's a party game, and it incorporates portions of charades and taboo and things like that. But it's all about title recall, or that is the title of songs or plays or movies or books. And there are three different rounds, and you can play in teams, or you can play free-for-all. That works really well with odd numbers of people. And during the first round, you're able to do anything just about. You just can't use any of the words, of course, and you can't sing if it's a song. You cannot sing the song. You can mention parts of the lyrics. In the second round, you're able to say one single word and then make, of course, pantomime-like actions. The other person who you're trying to get to guess only gets one guess, and then if they get it wrong, you have to pass and move on to the next card. The third round is absolutely hysterically impossible. You cannot say anything at all. It is complete charades. And all what comes down is some of the actions and words that have been used to describe the clues in the past. These are all the same clues, and so you're just progressing harder and harder throughout the game. This I can highly recommend for any of you who like party games. But what was amazing is that we were able to lure in some people who do not normally like party games, and they loved it. They got into it, they had a blast, they were able to let go and just enjoy themselves in the moment and getting lost with this game. Well, here for you are a couple of rounds of an example of round one for our seven-person Time's Up Title Recall game on Friday night at Origins. It included John Moeller, myself, Sean, T.C. Petty III, Fred and David McKenzie, and I hope you find it as hilarious as we did playing it.
So I'm calling for you.
Yep.
Blue.
I can't turn them on.
That's all right. Guessing.
Yeah.
Ready?
Go.
Television show, Dick Wolf. There's many series. They just had one for Los Angeles. They have one for New York.
Well,
most of them are in New York.
Oh, my God. I'm totally blanking on the name. I know what it is.
Things.
Dunk Dunk.
Yeah.
Long Order.
There you go. this is a country, but it's also a Terry Gilliam movie with...
Brazil.
There you go. These are things you might find in the ground, but it's also...
Groundhogs.
No, it's... they're
squirrels. Well, moles.
Rivals. Yeah, there you go.
Time.
Wow.
I was like,
I was so involved in this.
That's the problem.
I guess it's a book and a movie, but I don't know anything about it.
Yeah. Cards are getting heavy on that side.
Yeah, I think John's got
more of the ones that no one can guess.
Ready, set.
Sorry, man. Terrible.
The Beatles' famous album, last album.
White album.
Another Walking Across the Road.
Oh, Abbey Road. Oh,
yeah. Go.
This is the Jamie Lee Curtis.
A Fish Called Wanda.
The Muppets did this. It's at Holiday Times.
Muppets Christmas. Oh no.
It's a Dickens novel.
Oh.
Dickens.
Oh.
You. If you give a damn, you.
Lost me there.
Time. I don't get that.
I know what it is.
I know the answer, but I don't.
I have no way.
Give it to him.
Oh, I know the one you're talking about.
I know it too because I tried to.
All right, wait. Do I? I have to here. I put that one back in.
What should we do with that?
That's what I tried to.
Just take it out. Just move it all around.
One of the games that was requested for me to check out was Quarriors by WizKids. Now, I had heard a bit about this game before I went to Origins, but didn't consider demo in it until a few people had mentioned that they'd like to see more about it. And Quarriors is a dice-based game. It's sort of like a deck-building game, but instead of using cards, you use dice. And, of course, my blog being Dice Hate Me, I was a little bit nervous about trying it out, but even though I knew I was probably going to lose, I still love rolling dice, and I thought I would go and at least see what it was all about. I'm here to tell you that after the demo, I love this game. It's not the deepest game in the world. It's not going to be a Dominion killer for people who love Dominion and things like that. But for people who are casual gamers or kids or even people who just want to have fun with dice and love rolling dice, this game is fantastic. And the components are amazing. All the dice are custom. They're hand-etched. And they are some of the finest components that I've seen in games to date. And because it's by WizKids, you know that it's going to be light, it's going to be fun. And Sean, who played it with me, along with the demo from the person who was playing the game and demoing from WizKids, also really got into the game. We had a good time playing. And here's a little bit about Quarriors directly from WizKids.
So Quarriors is a deck-building game. Have you played other deck-building games like Dominion? Or?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, cool. Then we're good. We can just start right now. So in Quarriors, the goal of the game is to manage your resources, which we call Quiddity. If you look at the dice, we've got these like little teardrop symbols with numbers. Some have ones, some have twos. Occasionally, rarely, you'll see a three. As we manage our resources, what we want to do is buy either spells or monsters that we'll eventually put into play and score for glory. Glory is your ultimate goal in this game. Depending on the number of players, there's a different glory goal that you want to achieve. And as we look at the different monsters that we have laid out here in front of us, they're all worth a different amount of glory. It basically reflects their overall power in the game. So the more powerful monsters, like a Quake Dragon, will score you the most glory, whereas your lowly assistant will only score you one. And then there are spells that might help your monsters fight other monsters, that sort of thing. Every player starts with the same 12 dice. You have 8 basic Quiddity and 4 assisted dice, which are monsters or Quiddity, depending on what side they come on. And as we look at each of these cards, it tells you each of the 6 sides of the die in question. Setting up the board is really easy. There are always 3 basic cards that you always put into play. Then you'll play 3 spells. There are 6 different spells. Each of those spells have 3 different levels. And then there are 10 different monsters that you can play. Each of those 10 monsters have 3 different levels. And you always put 7 into play. So 7 monsters, 3 spells, 3 basic. And then obviously you put out the corresponding deck. The best way I think to get into Warriors is just to jump right into it. So we're going to take our dice, put them into our pouches, shuffle our decks. And then, I'm going to go first just for simplicity.
Yeah.
Every turn, what you want to do is you want to draw out 6 dice. So I'm going to draw 3. And then I roll. Okay, and it looks like I got a lot of Quiddity that I could buy stuff with. So that's 7 Quiddity. No monsters to put into play because I didn't roll any of them. So, I'll look on the board, see what I have for purchasing. Now, you can only make 1 purchase per turn. So even though I have seven, I couldn't buy, like, say, a Portal for four and a Death Dealer for three.
Gotcha.
So I think what I am going to do, though, is I'm going to take four of that, buy a Portal. Now, when I spend Quiddity to buy something, it goes to my used pile, as does whatever I purchase. And then whatever's left over is just left over and used. And then we go to the next player's turn.
Okay.
Your first couple turns generally go pretty fast.
Yeah.
Now, one of the friends of Dice Hate Me, and people that we really love, are the people at Moustache Games. In particular, Christina Ramos, who I got a chance to meet at Origins and talk to at length about Rowboat and their upcoming release, Hike. We were lucky enough to be able to take some time and sit down and talk with Christina about Hike and play a game. She gave me a demo copy. I need to introduce it to Monkey238 and see what she thinks about it, but I know she's going to love it because we had a blast playing it there. They had a nice setup. They had a place in the exhibition hall, which was really nice. They were able to demo a lot of the games. They sold out of Hike while they were there, so that was fantastic. And they also had a setup in the open playing area where they had a tent set up, so the people could go inside the tent and test out Hike inside the tent. It was a brilliant setup. A lot of fun times. They had some very rabid fans there that were able to talk about Hike, and you could experience it through their eyes. Overall, I think Moustache Games is really going places. I think they're a great company. They seem to really love what they do and their fans. And I talked a bit with Christina before we played our first game of Hike, just about Moustache and kind of what they're doing for their production values and the future of what they would like to do in prototyping and what they can bring to the public. So here's Christina talking with me about Moustache Games.
Like, who's your printer?
First run of Rowboat was with Cartamundi.
Right.
Right now we're working with Quality Playing Cards.
Okay.
Quality Playing Cards has been a great resource to us because they've allowed us to add another mechanism to game making the game, which is doing a professional quality prototype.
Right.
So what we ended up doing was we wanted a prototype where it wasn't just us creating by hand all the different elements of gameplay, but something that brought it to life much more visually, so we took prototyping to the next layer for us, and we were able to see how we can better create artwork that enhanced gameplay.
Right.
So, you know, a nicer, prettier bug doesn't necessarily make the move better, but people visually are drawn to it a lot more, and they tend to want to play it.
Absolutely.
And it turns, I think it's a better way to turn card and game making as a whole into an art form.
Right.
And you're seeing games like Dixit, beautiful.
Beautiful. Love that game.
So it's something that we're gamers, but we're also visual thinkers, and we're trying to find that mashup of both. And so Quality Playing Cards gave us that opportunity to say, you know, with a smaller run like Hike, for a small startup like us, we can do a small run on even a big scale for us, a couple of thousand,
right,
and have a prototype to bring to toy fairs to see how it's playing with both the industry, but also just gamers as a whole. Do they like it?
That's great.
Is it a game that appeals to, you know, strategy thinkers as much as kids? And if so, how can we demo it better?
And how influential was Toy Fair?
Yes.
Yes.
February?
Yeah, February. How influential is that for you to move forward as a company and with the games?
It was huge. It was huge. It, you know, you rely on your retailers and your buyers to have the product on the shelf and available because we can only do so much as a 2-3-person company.
Right.
I'm sorry, I meant to say three. So essentially, Toy Fair allowed us to see from an industry perspective what we needed to do and what we needed to consider about our game. You'll notice that I don't know, you know, how many people actually paid attention of the progression of our game. But at Toy Fair, we had a completely different logo. We had our symbols on the right-hand side of our cards. And the more that we continued, you know, showing it and playing it, we realized there's smarter things we can be doing.
That's good, yes.
And so we've changed our logo to be more representative of the artwork on the opposite side, and we feel better about that.
Right.
So
through your prototyping, you're able to now stay more flexible so you can get more playtesting in.
Exactly.
And, yeah.
We are able to see the retailer, okay, we have a lot more flexibility with packaging. We haven't pulled the trigger on it yet. So, you know, is this size box convenient for displaying? Is this sort of placement good? You know, what can we do to help make it better?
Right.
And so they give us their advice that they can, and we take it. You know, you have to take what you choose. We have different lists, the need to haves and the likes.
Right.
You know, so we're trying to figure out what do we need to do and what do we have to do, and prioritize from there. And it makes, I think, makes the world difference for a small company like us that doesn't really have the chance to take risks like bigger companies that can, you know, throw a few products out there and say, hey, does it work or doesn't work?
Right. You're not
it
Hasbro.
Has to work.
You're
it not, has to work. Yeah. I'm like, all right, it's got to work.
Well, let's check out Hike, and then we can talk about how the development of the game.
Absolutely, and it gives us the opportunity to, we've got a game like Robo, where we've got gamers that enjoy getting in on a game that can be strategic, it can be lengthy, it can be short, it can be anything that they really want it to be, because we've got the novice version and the standard version with bidding.
Right.
And with Hike, it's a good way for us to get kids on board as well.
Yeah.
And it's still appealing for adults, because we continue to play it with our friends. And as you saw, you know, at the convention, adults come over and they want to play and hang out and look for a social game that attracts gamers and social people that just want to play something in their spare time.
And they have just announced that they are going to be holding their first annual National Rowboat Championships at Gen Con Indy. So if you plan to be at Gen Con, look up Moustache Games and make sure that you're in the rowboat tournament, because they have some great prizes planned, some really big prizes planned. And speaking of prizes, Christina Ramos and Moustache Games have promised that we're going to have a great giveaway on DiceHateMe.com at the end of the summer. We'll be giving away copies of Rowboat and probably copies of Hike. So make sure you watch DiceHateMe.com, and after Gen Con, I'll be back with more about Moustache Games and their giveaway. Okay, so Origins wasn't all about playing other people's games. I also took one of our own. And as we mentioned in our Origins preview last week, Monkey created a game, and we've been designing, developing, and playtesting it for the past couple of weeks. The reception to the prototype at Origins was extremely positive, and we received a lot of great feedback, a lot of which we've already incorporated into the latest version.
Yeah, so while Chris was off playing games at Origins, I actually worked, and I got a production timeline together, and I ordered some more prototypes for our playtest groups, and I actually developed a subpage for DiceHateMe.com, all in preparation for the big project, and we're almost ready to announce what it's all about.
Yeah, almost. We're excited to finally be producing our own game, but we also want to do this right. So that means making sure we have everything ready before we start the ball rolling. So for now, all you'll get is a tease and a hint. And who knows, there may be a very obvious clue as to the title of our secret project in this very podcast.
Ooh.
So if you want to know more about our project, or you'd just like to chat about board games, you can always find us on Twitter. I'm DiceHateMe.
And I'm Monkey238. And if you follow me on Twitter, you can tell all your friends that you're friends with a game designer. That's pretty cool.
And don't forget to check out DiceHateMe.com, because that's where all the good stuff lives. Until next time, this is Dice Hate Me.
And Monkey238.
Saying thanks for listening.
And may all your rolls be sixes.
I had a gurgle.
Nice.